Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the people who I've come to admire tremendously for his intelligence, all the more impressive as he is a very young man, but one whom I've had the privilege of knowing since, well, I think he was a gleam in his father's eye, as a matter of fact, his father being former Undersecretary of Defense Doug Feith, and we are speaking of one of his many sons, David Feith, now an editorial writer for the Wall Street Journal Asia, based in Hong Kong. He has served in similar capacities back in New York, also as an assistant editor at Foreign Affairs magazine. His writing is superb, his intellect impressive, and his contributions to our understanding, particularly of the stakes for the United States and what's developing in Asia, is really extraordinarily appreciated. David, welcome back. It is so good to have you with us.
Thanks, Frank. Glad to be here.
We're talking on the occasion of the visit by Rodrigo Duterte, the president of the Philippines, to Beijing. It comes at a very dramatic moment in U.S. Philippine relations as a result of Duterte's somewhat colorful views and intemperate comments, but more to the point, some of what seems to be some strategic maneuvering by him. Talk about all that, if you would, against the backdrop of what's happened lately in Beijing.
Sure. Well, with President Duterte in the Philippines, who has been in office for all of 3 or 4 months, just since June 30th, we are seeing at really light speed a very dramatic shift in the regional balance of power in Asia, and in particular in relations between the Philippines and the United States, and between the Philippines and China. What we've seen is that the new president has come into office and has looked to shift the relations of Manila with the U.S. and with China just about 180 degrees. There remains some significant uncertainty about what he intends as a practical matter, what he might follow through with, what he'll be able to convince his public and his military and even his own cabinet to go along with. But the rhetoric is absolutely explosive. He's been mounting tirades, foul-mouthed tirades against President Obama. And just today, visiting Beijing, speaking in the Great Hall of the People, he said, "America has lost now. I've realigned myself in your ideological flow," that is speaking to a crowd in the Chinese capital. "And maybe I will also go to Russia to talk to Putin and tell him that there are three of us against the world, China, Philippines, and Russia. It's the only way." He said further, "I have separated from them, the United States. So I will be dependent on you for all time," he said to China. "But do not worry, we will also help as you help us." This is extremely significant for the security considerations in East Asia.
Indeed. And David Feith, you alluded to the question of whether or not this might go down well in the Philippines. Our friend Gordon Chang has actually opined on our air that he may be impeached if he perpetrates what many would consider to be such a betrayal of Philippine, well, sovereignty, I guess, at the very least, security interests, it would seem, at a minimum.
Well, there is rising chatter of impeachment possibility and also of a military coup, possibly. Both impeachments, moves to impeach and moves to mount military coups are both fairly common in the Philippines. The Philippines has had democracy since the fall of the Marcos regime in 1986, but it's always been a bit of a messy process, and there have been several coups and coup attempts, and it is surprising just how quickly, how immediately in the term of President Duterte, these whispers have started to climb into real rumors and discussion. It was not, for example, the case in the past 6 years under President Aquino, who was, among other things, growing the economy, and after an initial attempt to make nice with China and to pursue some joint projects, he very clearly saw how China was undermining Philippine sovereignty in the South China Sea. And the Chinese then went and grabbed Scarborough Shoal, which was a strategic spot just off the strategic port of Subic Bay off the main Philippine island of Luzon. After that, President Aquino went and deepened defense ties with the United States and with Japan and with Vietnam and others. There was no coup or other rumors at the time under President Aquino. This is not a constant in Philippine politics, but it does happen, and already it's being spoken about. And there was an especially interesting case last week where former Philippine President Fidel Ramos, who might be the only politician in the Philippines more popular right now than President Duterte, issued a blistering op-ed blasting President Duterte for the way he's gone about this diplomatic turn. And it's especially surprising because Ramos is a military man himself, and he has been a supporter of Duterte and helped. So the fact that former President Ramos, a former top Philippine military officer, is beginning to rebuke him so harshly certainly got people discussing just how sustainable Duterte's shift might be, given that the military is extremely suspicious of China and rather close historically and especially these days with the United States.
David, let me ask you about something else that you've opined about recently, and that is China's ongoing and very close relationship with Pyongyang, which seems to be, as ever, providing the kind of political cover for North Korea that is sustaining it at a time when it's coming in for a lot of criticism over its nuclear and ballistic missile tests. Talk about that relationship, if you would, because we're often told by so-called experts that we just need to get China to use its influence with North Korea to amend its ways. Doesn't sound like that's in the cards, if I read you right.
I think, unfortunately, that is right. The China-North Korea relationship really is extremely important, and especially as it looks increasingly likely that the North Korean nuclear threat might be the single most immediate global security threat facing the next U.S. president, understanding it and understanding how China fits in is especially important. And as you suggested, China has a very long and deep history of, in some cases, aiding proliferation in North Korea, in other cases, simply turning a blind eye or running interference for North Korea's drive for nuclear weapons. And yet at the same time, all kinds of folks in the U.S. and elsewhere speak about China with some confidence as the key to solving the problem, that China can be brought on side, and you know, China is very frustrated with the assertiveness of young Kim Jong-un, and therefore there might be ways to get China to really twist the screws on North Korea. Unfortunately, there just isn't evidence of that happening. And there isn't evidence if you look at China's sanctions enforcement, and there isn't evidence if you look at the process of trying to write new sanctions at the United Nations. And this underscores how difficult the project will be for the next U.S. president, because the usual reasons given for China's unwillingness to pressure North Korea are that China does not want instability on its northeastern border. They don't want refugee flows coming from North Korea if there's instability in North Korea. And the second main reason given is that China doesn't want South Korean troops on its border who are allied with the U.S., and they certainly don't want U.S. troops. Those are good and very important reasons, but even still, there are other absolutely fundamental reasons that need to be understood, namely that there remains communist solidarity between Beijing and Pyongyang. And for Beijing, which is extremely sensitive these days about the standing of the Communist Party, especially the regard of the history of the Communist Party in the eyes of the public in China, it's unlikely, it's hard to imagine China pushing North Korea over the edge and abandoning, for example, all the history of the Korean War, which remains one of the pillars of the Mao and the Communist Party mythology used still by the Communist Party leaders in China to sustain themselves and to cement their legitimacy. So the ties between Beijing and Pyongyang are extremely deep, and that needs to be understood, I think.
This is a subject we'll be returning to, I hope, with your help. David Feith, for the moment, thank you so much for joining us, and keep up your great work at The Wall Street Journal Asia. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, we'll be speaking with my friend Kevin Freeman. And more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say our guest once again is Kevin Freeman, a man we typically turn to for his extraordinary expertise on matters involving economic warfare and the security of our economy and financial sector. I'm very pleased to say, however, that Kevin is a man of many parts, including part Native American, part Cherokee, as it happens, and is going to be involved in a very important and really quite extraordinary event Friday on the National Mall at the Washington Monument from 8 until 5. And I've invited him back to talk a little bit about this program and why it is so extraordinary. Kevin, I could go on and on about his many credentials, including his two superb books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan, the work he does at globaleconomicwarfare.com. But I want to focus particularly on this upcoming event and welcome you back for that purpose. Kevin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Frank.
So tell us a little bit about what is going on at the Washington Monument on Friday of this week.
Well, Pastor Nigel Bigpond, who's a friend of mine from Oklahoma, he has the Morning Star Church in Oklahoma, and a group of other tribal leaders, council leaders, decided it, months ago that we should get on the National Mall, All Tribes Gathering, that's what it's called, All Tribes D.C., and proclaim forgiveness from the native peoples towards the nation that has in many ways wronged them, and literally grant forgiveness even though the nation hasn't really asked for it. And I think it was sparked by, you know, seeing the division and the deaths that resulted from the rioting at Black Lives Matter and things like that. The native peoples have been oppressed and pushed off the land and stolen from and so forth. But unforgiveness begins to destroy a people. And the native peoples have suffered from alcoholism and poverty and so many things. And by forgiving and granting forgiveness, even when it's not been asked for, it provides a release from those spiritually, those things. And Pastor Bigpond and the others in the council just believe that this could be a spark that helps to heal our nation.
Well, let's talk more about that in a moment, but just the wellspring of this extraordinarily generous sentiment that deserves a little description, too. This is something that is representative of tribes across America, all different tribal communities, I take it, and needless to say, there is much to be forgiven. But as you've indicated, Kevin Freeman, the nation hasn't quite put itself in a position of asking for this. So talk a little bit about the genesis of this very, very generous act.
Well, you can go one of two ways. You can say we want to be victims or we want to forgive and live. And Billy Graham in 1975 spoke to a group of 100 tribal leaders and said that spiritually, if the native peoples would awaken, they could help bring America back to the founding principles, to the principles of opportunity and so forth. And so that's been in Pastor Bigpond's heart since 1975, and he's just, you know, it's just exploded with this idea that this is what we need to do now. This country is in desperate shape. We see the I actually preached it at Pastor Big Pond's church on economic warfare and how you can prepare and protect. And the answer that he gave was, you know, this is not a political answer. There's not a economic answer. There is a spiritual answer. And that's the reason behind that, you know, maybe as many as 1,000 tribes gathering. From the very large, which is Cherokee, which is the largest native tribe, to Pastor Big Pond is a Yuchi, which there's just a handful left, and he's full-blood Yuchi. So we're going to gather together and proclaim forgiveness.
And again, this is from 8 until 5 o'clock on the National Mall at the Washington Monument tomorrow. And Kevin, I did want to ask you a little bit more about the contrast between the kind of victimhood and grievance mongering that we've seen from others who have proclaimed their grievances against America, notably, as you mentioned, the Black Lives Matter movement. But I think you could probably throw in La Raza and sort of the Hispanic grievance mongers, as well as, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood and its various front organizations. Would you talk a little bit about both the contrast here and why this is obviously much to be preferred over the other model?
Well, I believe the native peoples recognize that the grievance industry is not for the benefit of those that were supposedly grieved. It is a political exploitation tool in most cases. And, you know, certainly there is a need to understand the racial problems and issues and difficulties, but it's best found not in protest and argument. It's best found, we believe, in spiritual surrender and forgiveness. And we're trusting God Almighty to watch over what we're doing. And if God's on your side, if God be for us, who can be against us idea. So we've just decided that that's the biblical model. It's the Christian model. And those that are demanding their rights, it often creates chaos and sows discord and disharmony. And for the good of our nation, we used to be a melting pot where we would come together. That's a part of the idea behind this, is we're Americans too. We're Christian believers, Americans that happen to have a native ancestry. And we want to uphold the good truths of biblical truths and American truths. And the other is, you know, as Abraham Lincoln said, a house divided against itself cannot stand. We want to go the opposite. We want the house to stand. We want to come together. And we believe that God will watch over us and reward us for forgiving. And we're asking God for forgiveness for our unforgiveness of the past.
This is an extraordinary time. Obviously, we're having this conversation, Kevin Freeman, as you know so well, in the endgame of an election in which there has been much division. If, in fact, this spirit were to take hold beyond the tribal leaders and representatives of the Native American community in this country, is it really a chance for whomever might be our next president to seize upon this concept to begin that process that is urgently needed, for sure, especially in the wake of yesterday's debate, to bind the nation's wounds and ensure that this House does stand united?
Well, with God, all things are possible. That's what we'll be doing, is crying out to God. And if we want to make America great again, it will not happen by dividing us into victim groups. The only way to make America great again will be to unite, to come together, to be the United States of America.
Well, this is the moment for it to happen, for sure. My prayer is that the spirit of this event on Friday at the Washington Monument, Kevin Freeman, will inspire people not just in the nation's capital but across this land to follow this very, very generous and much needed spirit of forgiveness. Thank you for your involvement in all of this. I know you will be speaking at 1 o'clock, but the program will go from 8 until 5 on Friday the 21st. For more information about this important event, check it out at alltribesdc.org. Kevin, again, thank you for all you do for us and others. Keep it up. We'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, we will be speaking with our colleague Fred Flights at the Center for Security Policy about the latest debacle with respect to the Iran deal and more. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Fred Flights, my colleague at the Center for Security Policy, where he serves as our vice president, senior vice president for programs and policy, is in the house, I'm very pleased to say, a career intelligence professional with time at the Central Intelligence Agency, the State Department under John Bolton. Fred Flights, it's good to have you back as always. Thank you for joining me.
Good to be here, Frank.
Well, you've just unburdened yourself of a piece at National Review about the debate last night. Why don't we start with that?
Well, Frank, as an intelligence officer, I was focusing on this claim by Hillary Clinton when asked about these damaging WikiLeaks disclosures, which cover so many damaging things, including the hostility of her campaign against Catholics. As a Catholic, I'm pretty upset about. But she tried to say, well, we can't talk about that because 17 U.S. intelligence agencies said that Russia did these hacks and Russia's trying to interfere in our election. Frank, that isn't true. It's true a memo was issued by two intelligence entities, the Office of Director of National Intelligence, the Department of Homeland Security, that said the hacks, and I'll quote, are consistent with the methods and motivations of Russian-directed efforts. But it didn't say they had any evidence that Russia has done this. And my concern is, this was an unprecedented, unclassified memo issued right before the election, and I have no doubt the Clinton campaign ordered it, and the Obama administration was happy to provide it. And this is another example of intelligence agencies being manipulated for political purposes by the Democrats.
Yeah. These happen to be two agencies that over time have been, as you know, Fred Flights, extraordinarily, accommodating, shall we say, to the political demands of the White House. On the one hand, the Director of National Intelligence, for example, describing the Muslim Brotherhood famously as a largely secular group, for example. And of course, Jay Johnson at Homeland Security doing everything he possibly can to promote the meme of the pro-Islamist line of the Obama administration. So again, this doesn't come as a terrible surprise, but Hillary certainly asserted it in a full-throated way repeatedly and challenged Donald Trump over the fact that he didn't get it because 17 agencies had conclusively found this to be true. Fred, when you look at this kind of politicization of intelligence, what are the downside risks associated with it as a professional officer in your own right?
Well, 2 points. When intelligence agencies engage in political activities like this, an incoming administration isn't going to trust them. And I think this is really dangerous because the president has to have candid discussions with his intelligence advisors so he can make decisions to defend our national security. He can't be afraid to have them because they would leak out. But let me add one other thing. Whether the Russians were involved in that or not in this, this demonstrates how all these Democratic officials seem to have no understanding at all at the need for Internet security. I'm wondering whether Podesta's password was password for his emails. And these are the people that Hillary Clinton will be putting in high national security positions. And that's a scandal no one's talking about.
You know, another person that would likely be placed in such a position would be Donna Brazile. And she had a very interesting exchange with Fox News last night in which she essentially disavowed that she had passed a question given her by somebody at CNN onto the Clinton campaign during the primary season. The suggestion being that not only were these emails being supplied by Russian hackers, but that they were doctoring the emails. Fred, I know nobody, and I'm sure not you, with everything else on your plate, has had a chance to mine all of these various disclosures from WikiLeaks or to assess, if that could be done, how accurate they are. But talk just, if you would, about this sort of effort to obscure and deflect and otherwise disassociate themselves, the authors or the subjects of these emails, from them.
Well, It's possible some of the emails were distorted, but the Clinton campaign hasn't provided any evidence of that. In fact, they've refused to disavow what's in most of the emails, and in some instances, they've confirmed what was in them, including some of Hillary Clinton's speeches. And I think it's simply, you know, this is stolen information. People are complaining about that. Stolen and leaked information is published by the New York Times, you know, constantly.
Every day.
And that's never a defense that Republicans and members of Congress have gotten away with using. And I might add that Donald Trump's tax returns were also illegally provided to the press. And I don't remember hearing the Clinton campaign complaining that was pretty serious violation of the law.
Yeah, I don't remember that either, Fred Flights. Let me turn to one of the other hardy perennials of our conversations, Fred. And again, our guest is Senior Vice President at the Center for Security Policy, Fred Flights. You have written Obama Bomb about the national security fraud that has been perpetrated by the Obama administration, starting with spade work done by Hillary Clinton, to be sure. Give us a flavor, Fred, of the latest. I can think of these conversations as kind of concession watch. What the latest concessions have been by the United States government and those that seem to be perhaps in the offing with respect to the Islamic Republic of Iran?
Well, the latest concession, I should say it's stunning, but nobody's surprised anymore. This was in an article by Adam Credo in the October 19th Washington Free Beacon that Iran is seeking many billions of dollars more in ransom to free U.S. hostages. The Iranians have captured more Americans and more individuals with U.S. green cards since the controversial prisoner swap for ransom last January. And now, according to Credo, Iran is trying to negotiate to get more ransom payments to release these Americans. And, I mean, you and I have talked about that. Of course they're doing that. The Iranians realize that they have a window before President Obama leaves office to exact more concessions from the United States to protect the president's legacy nuclear agreement. And behold, here it is.
Fred, one of the other things that the administration has been doing, apparently, is trying to take steps to encourage and facilitate foreign entities in doing business in Iran. There's also, of course, an effort been made recently to enable Boeing to do the same by selling many, many billions of dollars worth of aircraft to Iran. I wanted to ask you about this against the backdrop of a report recently of a major war game that Iranian forces engaged in which old Boeing aircraft, apparently configured for aerial refueling purposes, were participating. Fred, again, as a former intelligence officer, what concern should the United States have that we may well be increasing the power projection capabilities of the Iranians by this sale going forward?
Well, I'd like to first remind your viewers that John Kerry has been described as Iran's principal international trade officer. He's been so active in trying to promote trade with Iran under this deal. I think there's no doubt that Iran is trying to acquire civilian airliners from Airbus and Boeing to use them to transport terrorists, probably to Syria, maybe to other countries, possibly to Venezuela. And, you know, these war games show something that we really should have seen coming. Congress has fought hard to stop these transfers of these aircraft until Iran disavows terrorism, and I think they've just played right into their hands.
We will be talking at length about the Iran Venezuela connection, in fact, in the remaining two segments of our program, Fred Flights. But I think that the concerns that you're expressing here about increased terrorism, increased military threats to our own personnel, notably the Houthi proxies for Iran in Yemen, but also, you know, what Hamas and Hezbollah are up to, as well as the Quds Force and so much more in the Middle East. It's really of concern, and it's a metastasizing problem. I think there's no other way to describe it. We'll continue to track it closely, as do you, Fred Flights. We appreciate the work that you're doing for us at the Center for Security Policy, as well as your past service to our country. We'll talk next with Russ Dallin about the meltdown in Venezuela and what the Iranians, among others, are doing to try to prop up the Maduro regime. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's a great privilege and pleasure to have with us once again the president and editor-in-chief of the Latin American Herald Tribune. He formerly was president of the Daily Journal in Venezuela and has been active with the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, among many other incarnations and contributions. He is, of course, Russ Dallin. We're always delighted to have him with us to talk about a particularly serious, festering sore now in our own hemisphere, namely Venezuela, in which he has spent a lot of time over the years. Russ, thank you very much for joining us. I'm hoping that you're going to be the bearer of some good news for a change, but I'm not seeing much evidence of it. Welcome back.
Thank you, Secretary Gaffney. I wish I had some good news for you and your esteemed listeners.
Are you concerned that things are continuing to unravel in Venezuela at the moment? And to the extent that would be the case, what is the principal cause of that unraveling at the moment?
Well, if you had to go look at one single principal cause, it would be the tried and failed communist policies that we've seen fail all over the world, but Venezuela has put them in a new bottle and called them 21st century socialism. Essentially, it's just Castro communism, and if we needed any further evidence that you can take Cuban communism and stick it in the most potentially the richest country in the world with the world's largest oil reserves and still bring them to the brink of bankruptcy, Venezuela is your test tube.
Proof positive. Does this strike you, this is a little bit off topic, but I can't resist in light of what you've just said, Russ, does it strike you as bizarre that there seems to be now this resurgent, enthusiasm for socialism, particularly among young people, Bernie Sanders supporters and the like, in the United States?
Utopia is a beautiful thing. If heaven would work with everybody instead of just the good people, we'd have heaven on earth. Unfortunately, that is not human nature. And sadly, what we know of human nature after all these years is that so far the best way to distribute resources is competition, and sadly, there's some countries that just don't get that.
As we talk about this, Russ Dallin, you've been chronicling some of the economic dislocation that's taking place as a result of this operation in Venezuela. Give us a flavor of what this is translating into in terms of the undoing of the state monopoly that exploits the vast oil wealth of the country, PDVSA, and for that matter, what's it's doing to the people of the country who are suffering apparently extraordinary privation at the moment.
It's sad. There's no other way to say it. There's malnutrition. You're watching a country that was one of the richest countries in Latin America devolve back to the jungle state of nature. There's no other way to say it. Venezuela has the fifth largest oil company in the world, and goes by its initials PDVSA or PDVSA in the Spanish initials names. And this past week, they've said basically that they're not going to, that if they don't get a break from creditors, they're not going to be able to pay their debts. The country and the company, PDVSA, as well as the sovereign, owe $15 billion from now until the end of next year. So through the end of 2017, they owe $15 billion, the two of them together. They don't have the money. They have less than $12 billion in their financial reserves, if that's even really there. And they are now asking creditors for a deferral of $7 billion of that $15 billion. And the way they asked him was warning, we don't have the money to pay you. Give us a break.
Yeah. They've tried floating bonds, as I understand it, without success. And I gather that the Congress of Venezuela, now in the hands of the opposition to the Maduro regime, has determined that there's something like $11 billion missing from the accounts of PDVSA. This really sounds like a formula for the whole enterprise to go belly up. Is that in the prospect, do you think?
It is a real prospect. I mean, when your creditor is telling you they can't pay you, then you really have to take them at their word. It's a unique negotiating strategy. In the old days, if you told the bank you couldn't pay your mortgage, well, you could try and refinance. But in today's world, it's not a binary outcome. You don't have to take it or leave it, because you can actually leave it as a bondholder and just sell those bonds. You don't want to be involved with these guys and get rid of them. And that's what people are doing in droves.
And so as you look at what is developing now, I'll be talking about this a bit further shortly with Susan Warner, who's warning about the involvement in Venezuela of Iran, for example, the Castros, the Chinese, for that matter. What's your prognosis, Russ Dahlin? You cover these things closely, of course, at the International Herald Tribune in Latin America. Is this country likely to be riven by some kind of upheaval, civil war, perhaps, in order to displace this government that, with the sort of communist ideology, has brought it to such grief?
Well, sadly, or however you want to look at it, Venezuela has no Second Amendment to guarantee the right to bear arms, and most of the good people of Venezuela do not have guns. The guns are sadly in the hands of only the military and the what we call malandros, the gangs and the bad people, who also kind of work with the government, are paid by them to cause mischief and given territorial rights. Even the FARC in Colombia and the ELN have run of Venezuela and export their drugs through Venezuela with the to the benefit and paying the officials of Venezuela, high officials who have been indicted in the United States. The Minister of Interior and Justice, before he was appointed in August, was indicted by the United States in Brooklyn. They unsealed the indictment because he didn't have an appointment. He was general in chief of the National Guard, which is the largest land-based part of the army. And he, once he was retired as general in jefe of the National Guard, the U.S. waited a month and then unveiled the indictment that had been done a year and a half for drug trafficking by this fellow. The next day, Maduro appointed him to be Minister of Interior and Justice, in charge of all the courts and all the police forces in the country. Essentially, we're talking about a narco state.
It's what it comes down to. We'll be talking more about that and its implications, not just for the long-suffering people of Venezuela and others in Latin America, but also for us, with Susan Warner right after the break. I do want to say thank you to you, Russ Dahlin. I hoped we mentioned FARC and other guerrillas in Colombia. I wanted to get your sense on the peace process there, but that will be for another day. In the meantime, thank you very much for the great work you do at the International Herald Tribune, Latin America. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. As promised, Susan Warner, up next.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by Susan Warner. She is a woman who has written extensively on matters involving Christian anti-Semitism, and of late on a subject related to the one we've just been discussing with Russ Dallin, namely the state of things in Venezuela, as well as their strategic implications, and specifically the ties between Venezuela and Iran. And Susan is, among other things, a co-founder of Olive Tree Ministries at the Emanuel Church in Wilmington, Delaware. You can find her writings, in addition to Gatestone, at Front Page Magazine, The Times of Israel, and elsewhere. Welcome back. Susan, it's good to have you, and thank you very much for your contributions to our understanding of what is going on in and through Venezuela and other parts of Latin America. It's good to have you with us.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
So you've written in a recent piece at Gatestone that there are some 6 million Muslims now living in Latin America, that Iran has opened up something like 80 cultural centers, apparently aimed at trying to either recruit more to the faith or at the very least to some of its malevolent behavior. Sort of put this all into perspective for us, would you, as to what's been going on, particularly in and with the active support of the Venezuelan regime?
Yeah, well, I think maybe giving you just a brief history of how I got interested in this was a friend of mine who writes and researches these issues, was a speaker in one of the classes that I teach. And that was the first time that I became aware that Iran was extending its reach into Latin America. Now, the thing that's most important about it is to recognize the connection between how Iran makes its connections with Venezuela and then how it brings its influences up into the United States. The issue of Iran is not just Iran per se. It's like making the Iran deal last year was not about Iran so much, and Israel recognizes this probably more than anybody. It really is recognizing that Iran works through proxies, and its proxies are, among others, are Hamas and Hezbollah and the Al-Quds force, or rather the Iranian Guard, which is more directly related to the government. Iran does all of its work through these various proxies, and it funds them. So, for example, what you have in Latin America is you have an example of not just cultural centers, that's just the surface of it, but what Iran has done through Hamas and Hezbollah, who are there now, you know, fighting in the trenches, if you will, not so much a war, but through the various methods that they use to intrude themselves or infiltrate a nation. Now, we've heard rumors, of course, of Iran infiltrating the United States in these kind of surreptitious kinds of ways through these various terrorist groups. Well, they're doing the same thing in Latin America and have been doing so, at least in recent memory. They've been doing this all the way back till the founding of OPEC in 1960-something.
And Susan, talk about specifically the tie-in between that kind of proxy operation in Latin America, funded by the Iranians, now presumably greatly facilitated in such funding by the immense amounts of money we've transferred to Iran as part of this so-called deal. But talk about the narco-trafficking piece of this especially, because it's that double whammy that's so concerning.
Exactly right. And so what happens is that Hamas, and I'm going to say specifically Hezbollah, is funded pretty directly by Iran. to the tune of about, they estimate between $100 and $200 million a year, which is really small change. So now what Hezbollah and Hamas does is they hook up with these drug traffickers, that these large drug trafficking cartels that are coming out of, not partly out of Venezuela, but in part they're coming out of Colombia, because Colombia is the manufacturer of the drugs. But since Colombia has been kind of clamping down on the large drug trafficking issues, what's happening is that it's pushing that drug trafficking in from Colombia and trafficked into Venezuela. Well, now, Iran has its own kind of drug problems in its own nation. But in reality, what it's doing is it's fighting drugs in its own nation while it's expanding the drug connections in Venezuela, which is the irony, of course, of all ironies.
And much of that is targeted at the United States, of course, where that
of course, that's exactly right. And so
forward.
What happens if you happen to be a researcher, what you'd look at is you'd look up some way of looking up narco trafficking of drugs into the United States, and you'd discover that from Venezuela there's a direct line into Central America and Nicaragua. And what happens is that not to advertise Donald Trump, but the issue is that he's raised is the porous southern border. And the porous southern border through which a lot of this narco-terrorism is kind of funneling, because the border is so porous. And so in the United States, what we have is basically the setting up of the drug trafficking that's already set up, and then indeed what you have connected with that is the terrorism connection. So the terrorists and the narco drug traffickers are moving up from, let's call it Colombia, Venezuela, up through mostly through Nicaragua, but then there are other more direct flights that go right into Florida, and then move up also through the Texas porous border. So you've got this narco trafficking with the terrorism coming in through airplanes and through the ground, but the ground seems to be the one that's most popular.
And what we're seeing when you net all this out is that the government of Venezuela, which has destroyed its economy and is literally starving its people to death, is essentially being propped up, as I understand it, Susan Warner, by sort of this kind of funding stream through narco trafficking and the Iranian connection, but also by active support from the Cubans and particularly, you know, the security services of Cuba. So you really have a witch's brew in this country. And just to close this out, what would you recommend we do as a government? We're about to get ourselves a new commander in chief. What should that individual do to try to stem this danger and also to hopefully stabilize the region, which is being tormented and greatly, I'm afraid, afflicted by these combined forces, particularly in Venezuela?
Well, it's interesting that you're asking. I'm not sure whether anybody knows what the solution is. It seems to be, first of all, the problem we have in the United States right now is just recognition of the problem. And the United States has been a kind of country in denial for the last however many years. And so while we're saying, yes, it is a problem, even the State Department knows that there's a problem with Venezuela's cooperation on drug trafficking. It does not cooperate. And so the State Department is very much aware of the fact that it doesn't cooperate. But at the same time, here we are trading with Venezuela over oil. 10% of our oil is coming from there. So you have this kind of irony of circumstances where the Congress has been, every now and then you'll see a House investigation of this situation, and everybody will kind of shake their heads and they'll say, yes, it is bad, it really is bad. And then they kind of pet themselves that they've done something. But in fact, really not much is being done. Now,
this is why your warnings at the Gatestone Institute are so valued and appreciated. And I hope that you will come back to keep us abreast of them. Susan Warner, thank you for your time today. We'll talk to you again in the very near future. I hope we'll talk to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.